Zumwalt, the 15th of July, 1987.
So, what I'm trying to get today is kind of an evaluation, you know, how it's been since you were CNO, and then to some extent also a little retrospective looking back, you know, at your own time. Especially looking forward on those things which you think the roots go back into your time, okay? And what you think of what's been happening to the Navy since your time. So if you want to start, and then I probably want to ask you some specific things.
Okay, I don't know whether you've had a chance to look at my book on Watch.
I have read it. I have it on my desk.
That will give you an earlier recollection than I would have now. The picture as I saw it, which was the picture that I presented to Secretary Chafee and Secretary Laird, and which I think was instrumental in their decision to pick me as CNO, namely that we had the aged fleet, and that we simply had to start refurbishing, modernizing, even if it meant cutting back greatly on the numbers, namely that our strategic force badly needed modernization, and thirdly that our personnel attitudes and the system greatly needed modernization.
You even say that you think that it was the third thing that really distinguished you from others.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, Project 60, as the book outlines, was the concept that put together this threefold approach to my 4 years. And during that entire time, in both briefing Secretaries of Defense and Presidents and Congressional Committees, we continued to say that the catastrophic reduction in ships from in excess of 900 under Tom Moore to less than 500 by the time I left office was the price we had to pay with budgets constrained in order to build up to a 600 ship Navy. And in essence, we finally got there. Presidents Nixon and Ford strongly supported the concept. Carter buggered it up during his 4 years, and we lost ground, or did not gain ground. Then Ronald Reagan came in and with a vengeance helped us get up to that 600 ship figure. In the strategic side, although we wasted far too much time on the debate as to what the specific variant of Trident should be, nevertheless we got that program started in a vote, you remember, initially it came out 49-47 on the Senate floor when Senator McIntyre, head of the Armed Services R&D Committee, led the fight to kill it. And one of the few times that Rickover and I were locked arm in arm working with Scoop Jackson, just barely got it through. Seems almost unbelievable today to realize that the most important element of our strategic deterrence came that close to being killed, but nevertheless, that has been on track ever since, and it's clearly in another 4 years going to be the overwhelming backbone of the most important of our three legs. I don't know how much you want to get into the personnel side. Does your charter encompass getting into that too?
It's my book to write,
and I
already have the first draft of the whole 16 chapters, which will need a lot of additional input, but yes, and I have run across, as you might well expect, I've run across very divergent opinions on your personnel, and therefore I kind of like to hear it a little fresh, and also how you think about it now.
Right. The book covers most of how I feel, namely that we were in a catastrophic personnel situation with the anti-war mood and with the anti-military bias in the country, and with the tremendous sacrifices that our people were having to make for very long deployments. Our reenlistment rates were at a historic low, 9.5%. This meant that over 90,000 of every 100,000 sailors coming in were leaving at the end of their 4 years, and we simply had to turn that around. So that from the point of management alone, we had to shock the system and give our prospective recruits and our present sailors some reason to reach through the miasma of anti-war, anti-military mood, and to have a reason to ship in or ship over.
Are you saying to me that part of it was the feeling that if you took a dramatic series of actions, that it would take a dramatic series of actions?
Right, right. Those were moves that one would never make today in a Navy where we have the highest quality in history and very high reenlistment rate. But the proof of the need for them, in my judgment, was that reenlistment rates went up 3.5-fold during that 4 years and continued to soar on up for the next couple of years after that 4 year period.
I had trouble with the table in the back, trying to figure what that meant. In terms of, I forget whether it's given in percentages or it's given in numbers, but I had a little trouble with that table. When you say it went up 3.5 times. 3.5 times.
Yeah. It was 9.5 when we started, and I think by the time I left office it was like 30%. And it continued to go on up as the impact of those initiatives played out. The second major reason for it, and I didn't stress this nearly as much at the time, because it wasn't a belief that would have been effective in the public, in the battle to capture the public mind, was that I very definitely considered myself uniquely a representative of the wartime sailor in Vietnam, having come to the job from command of the naval forces in Vietnam, and having spent 20 months in almost daily contact with the sailors in the boats. We'd always pick this morning the area of the worst firefights to go out and meet with the sailors and the officers and find out what was going wrong and where we weren't giving them the proper support and so on. And in visiting the hundreds of wounded, I came to Washington with the strongest and most vivid insight that here were thousands and thousands of heroic American males who had first volunteered to join the Navy and second volunteered to go fight in Vietnam in an unpopular war, who were not badgering me about why did I have to be here, but why do we have all of these Mickey Mouse regulations and rules that are nothing but a bother to a fighting man? And then as I thought back to our World War II era and recalled that all rules were off during that war, and we grew beards and mustaches and looked the other way with regard to the rules on beer and that sort of thing, that in peacetime one pretends we're always sacred. It seemed to me that we just simply had to revert to some of those principles of World War II and let the changes be, in essence, seen as a reward for these heroic guys. So I considered that I had a better feel than 90% of the brass at that time, having just come from the wartime theater. As I say, I stressed the original set of concepts more than I did that one because the war was so unpopular, and our fighting men were considered at that time such pariahs by a significant subset of our population and the Congress that it wouldn't have helped my campaign to stress it at the time.
Glad you made that point. Just as you say, it was not in the book.
Right. I guess that that what I would say then is that although I have not been in agreement with decision to build the additional nuclear-propelled aircraft carriers, and would have far preferred that we build three fossil fuel carriers for the two nukes each time, and would have preferred still more that we build 8 or 10 or 12 smaller carriers with helicopters and diesel aircraft. Nevertheless, overall, I've been a strong supporter of the President's program to build up the Navy, and I believe that his march toward 600 ships may well have begun at a time that he and I had a conversation when I was CNO and he came in to have lunch with me. And I hit it another lick with him in 1979 when we had lunch together in Los Angeles.
President Reagan.
Because he has been dedicated, I think, to that 600 ship number since he was a presidential candidate.
Did you by any, you probably did. You saw that article last year or two, I guess it is, on the V-Stall carrier versus nuclear carrier. Some captain wrote.
I didn't see it, I guess.
It was in the proceedings, and it's a side-by-side comparison. And I have to say that years ago, one time, and even during the speech down in Jacksonville, the Jacksonville Admirals were there, and I said, I think it's a great idea that President Carter is vetoing this carrier. So, but I don't know whether I've gotten softer-headed as time has gone on or what.
Well, did his comparison compare one against the other?
Yeah.
You see, that's an invalid comparison, what he has to do.
He's talking wings and everything, though.
But he has to compare it against what the equivalent number of dollars would buy, and it's probably 7 or 8 of those small carriers.
What he concludes is that that every time they look at a V-Stall, under present technology, that it keeps getting bigger and bigger until it costs two-thirds as much as the, I don't know whether it was conventional or nuclear, but
I think
the big carrier.
That may have been a valid number at the time, but with the tilt wing aircraft that's coming along, I think you'll have the aircraft that is capable of operating from a smaller platform. And it's just clear to me that we desperately need numbers. But anyway, that's an argument.
And that argument's still going on, because I interviewed somebody else 2 days ago, and I asked him on the V-22, and I thought the Navy was already committed to that. He said, no, not at all, and so on and so forth. Yeah. But as you say, that's a continuing argument.
Right.
But it does relate. I don't really want to break into that yet, but it does relate to the maritime strategy. But I'd like to stay with the ships for a minute.
Right.
One of the things, you, of course, were always for the, you felt that the surface needed redressing.
Yes. We had done better for the submarine Navy and for the aviation Navy than we had done for the surface Navy.
Now, I've heard the criticism made that the ships that were turned out as a result are very limited purpose. Would you think that?
They're clearly the FFG,
yeah.
Stark,
yeah.
is clearly not as capable as the larger chips. Again, that's not a valid comparison. You're going to compare what we get from the 50 Starks versus what we would have gotten from the 10 or 15 of another kind. And there, I think we're getting our dollars worth very effectively.
You're making a point like Dick Colvin did a study one time that really showed that numbers were very highly
sure.
important
sure.
Yeah, for seed control.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. In Project 50, as I recall, no, Project 60, I guess it's really with reference to the CEP in particular, that you charge them to prepare what in effect would today probably be called a maritime strategy,
right.
a justification for the Navy and so on. And I read that with great care. And also went over the fragmentary records that they have. And it seems to me that the CEP did a lot of very interesting things, and it was quite a breakthrough intellectually, you know, to establish it. But I didn't get any real sense of conviction that they achieved what I just said, that they got there.
I think in essence they became a very effective catalyst, not only because I had charged them to grab me once a month and force me to look up instead of at the immediate future, and because they became so knowledgeable in the details of the Navy that they were all over that Pentagon as effective advocates in a whole series of circles. Albert Wolfstetter to this day, you know, is in the White House, in the Pentagon, in congressional committees. Henry Rowan is all over. The fellow Charlie Hirschfeld, who continues to be prominent in scientific circles. Fred Hoffman and all the others. And so many of the specific ideas with which they came up got implemented in other channels because they, after all, were the kind of people who could only be used a couple of days a month, and because the staff that was serving them, first under Captain McKee and then under Captain Cockle, was after all limited in size, they served to help me keep focused on the need to kick off these various project in other media, where we concluded that we just couldn't do it within the CEP. And I think that the Sea Power initiatives that did get kicked off had their genesis in that way.
Cockle said that...
Who did Cockle?
Yeah, Bill Cockle.
You interviewed him.
Yes, I interviewed him at great length, as a matter of fact, because he had a lot of information. He said that... one of the first thoughts you had to get a brain trust was collect some PhDs, and they kept looking into long range planning and so on. They stayed way up there, so eventually you got yourself a bunch of operators together. Huh?
Yeah, we put the two together.
Yeah. But the maritime strategy. I've done a fair amount of work on it, and I see it basically as stemming out of, again, an intellectual development when Tom Haywood starts the SSG, really not with that quite in mind, but he starts it because he's worried about the tactical proficiency of the fleet and the war plans, and he wants some talented people to start looking at the situation afresh, in an atmosphere where they won't be sucked into the day-by-day busyness of things. So he sends them to the War College to sit there, and then Bob Murray gives them a little more structure, and off they go around to the fleet and talk to the different fleets and so on. And people call that sort of a bumblebee approach, and it's hard to say who fed on who, but there was a lot of pollination. Now, I am of two minds of how to see that in the time frame in which it occurred. Meaning, could it really have, when I reread your book, that's what struck me. I was thinking, well, you started out to make a maritime strategy. That's what you were really trying to do. You didn't call it that, because the justification is the strategy. But you didn't get there. Now, in your time, is it? But then, you see, the reason I'm of two minds is I don't think you probably could have gotten there at that time because of a lot of other things, like the divisions in the Navy were so strong.
I would put it this way. I think that we saw the need for a maritime strategy as the culminating effort to have a device that was defensible in congressional council and in public debate, but that we knew, as any very senior naval group does, approximately the direction we had to get started, and Project 60 was designed to implement approximately what the most didactic subsequent strategic concept would have called for, and that we just didn't feel that we had time in a telescoped four-year period of time to first develop the strategy and then Project 60. We had to get Project 60 out in my early days if we were going to get anywhere along toward implementing it in this terribly anti-war constrained budget era. It's the kind of shortcut that a surgeon takes when he has to do emergency surgery, as opposed to being able to do all the detailed workups that you would like to do when you've got time.
You know, this has, I mean, I lived through it just as you did. And you see, I've read your book with some care. But nonetheless, this kind of gives me a fresh dimension, you know, the emergency thing that I probably will need to stress. And it's the beginning, because you succeeded Tom Moore, right?
That's right.
And Tom, I've interviewed him, and he's, of course, delightful always. He's a lot of fun. I really asked him more on his chairmanship of the JCS in that period of time, which, of course, your period of time, too.
Right.
I like him a lot. I guess I'm prefacing that by saying that it's, and I'm not really trying to do him as a CNO, but he didn't really do much, except maybe keep the thing going.
Right. That I had the feeling that Tom's 4 years or 3 years as CNO were really an extrapolation of the past rather than getting on with dealing with the terrible problems that we had. Part that was because he had to fight a war.
Yes,
And therefore wasn't able to devote as much time to thinking. By the time I came there, it was clear that we were winding down the U.S. effort on what could have worked out very well if Mr. Nixon hadn't buggered it up for us with Watergate. And so you had to, and also the reenlistment situation had gone critical. The budget situation had gotten critical. You just had to get started. During that 4 years, we couldn't talk about this as glaringly publicly as I would have liked, and I picked up a few scars for the talking that I did do about it. We would have lost the naval war with the Soviet Union if we'd had to fight it, and that remained true in Holloway's watch, and it remained true in Hayward's watch, and it's only been in the Reagan administration that we have regained sufficient naval power to have better than a 50% probability of winning a war with the Soviet Union. So we were in a desperate situation, and we had to take even greater gambles with the present to get rid of ships and people in order to have the money to start building those ships for the future.
I remember that same little discussion. I caught you for about 5 minutes there, and you said you were at that day you were presiding over this Wallace, Davy. You remember that, by
the
way?
I have destroyed more ships than any Henry Admiral in history.
I was funny. But this is giving me a better sense of it. Because, as I say, I've got comments that don't digest with each other.
Yeah.
And part of what was missing is what you're telling me.
It's very, it was a very controversial 4 years. Not all of the old guard understood. Many of them did not. Have you happened to talk to Admiral Rivero?
No, I haven't. I know him, but I hadn't thought of it.
He's interesting because he better than any of the old timers that I inherited understood why we had to do what we were doing.
Where is he now?
He's in San Diego.
Oh, I could get down there to see him.
I think it'd be worthwhile doing so. I was very high on him, and
he's very sharp.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I worked hard to get him that ambassadorial appointment to Spain because he had done such a magnificent job in the Navy.
Now, as you look, I always tempted to go back or forward, but suppose we stayed with back. If you had it to do all over again, would you do anything much different?
I've been asked that a lot, and it's hard to say that I would.
Mm-hmm.
The one area in which I wish there had been more time to do more was in the briefing of the middle grades and senior grades as to the reasons for the dramatic changes. Now, God knows we did an awful lot of that. Put out the CNO sit reps. Every time I went to a Navy area, I'd meet first with all the top brass, and then with all the commanding officers, and then with a cross section of chief petty officers, and then a cross section of enlisted. And on some days I'd have as many as 12 sessions in San Diego or Norfolk or where have you. Try to disseminate why we were doing what we were doing. Nevertheless, I conclude after the fact that there were enough, maybe 15%, who resent change and fear change, that we, if we'd had the time, should have spent more time prepping them. But we had an awful lot of other things to get done.
You know, there are other people who have told me about other CNOs of making visits exactly in that kind of sequence in which they would brief people and so on. And I think the implication was that you didn't do this.
No.
Although they weren't talking about you, they were talking about...
No. Now, if you check the schedule, you'll see that we were doing exactly that sequence.
I noticed that there is very little in your book on the Naval Reserve.
That's an interesting comment. The last comment I can recall making to Admiral Holloway on my last day was that the area to which we had addressed ourselves the least was the Naval Reserve, and that I hoped he would devote more time to it. Again, under the concept of an emergency situation, it was one of those things that we had to try to fix later. We did some things, but And my concept, to the extent that I talked to the reserves during that period of time, and I tried to talk to the reserve admirals every time they came in, was that we had to get to a situation in which people were trained for a specific job each year for their mobilization billet. And we have, over time, gotten to that concept, but we had just sort of started to plan for it by the time I left.
It was chaotic, I know, as the reservists. And also, so many times I'd go on 2 weeks duty and then he'd say, what would you like to do?
Yeah.
And I'd have to invent my own duty, so to speak.
We now have reserves who have gone so many times to the same ship that in many cases they find themselves more experienced than the active duty people on the ship.
That's a good one. That's not the same. The numbers went down very drastically.
And that had to be done, too, because we were just pretending we were training, and with the larger numbers and in order to free up enough money to improve writing. And she had to come within budget level. She had to come down the numbers.
So, I mean, you simply are silent on these points, as far as I remember in your book. That's why I'm asking.
Yeah. And, there are probably 50 subjects that I wish I had written about in the book, which you have to cut.
Well, you see, the figures go down so drastically that with just those figures, it looks like, you know, you really didn't care about them, but that's not what the problem was.
No.
Yeah, okay. Now, looking forward, how do you see the contributions of your follow-on CNNs? I mean, or maybe you'd like to set it within the time, just as you did for yourself, you know.
I guess what I would say with regard to Ed Mahalway is that he did effectively what he told me he intended to do, namely to use his 4 years as a period to consolidate the changes. And I always felt that, that had to be done. As a matter of fact, what we really tried to do was to make the first 3 years the revolution, and the last year to begin the consolidation. And Jimmy continued that process, and I think effectively it continued also the battle to persuade the Congress and the public that we had inadequate numbers. He used to say that, as another way of saying we would lose the war, that in war time we would have to abandon our allies in the Western Pacific and concentrate on a major effort to reinforce Europe while probably abandoning the Eastern Mediterranean, which is another way of saying we'd lose, the odds were. And Tom Hayward chose to say it, that we had a 1.5 ocean navy to deal with a 3 ocean threat. But we all three kept the pressure on that we were in a bad way.
In the records, Hayward is the I know what you're talking about of skirting as near and saying that publicly as you can. In fact, I think you quote a piece in the book of part of your testimony.
Yes, right, I do.
In Haywood's time, he actually comes right out bluntly and really shakes them by saying something in about so many words.
Well, I did too. As a matter of fact, Laird was called by congressional committees expressing great concern that I had said the odds were we would lose the war in public testimony. And so he called me up and said, but you've got to at least say, or else escalates a nuclear war. And I said, I'd be delighted to say that. That makes the picture even gloomier.
Is that in the book?
I don't think so. I'm not sure whether it's in there or not, but that happened.
Okay. Haywood also said to me that he invented a new category called unsafe to steam, or, unsafe to steam, unsafe to fly. Had that hit you?
I was not aware that that was a category that he used, and that would equate to our C-4 readiness.
I think it was...
Was it worse?
Yeah. This was not... this was... He actually authorized skippers to say that they couldn't carry out their orders because they didn't have the proper mix of personnel, because he was 23,000 petty officers short, you know.
Right.
You see, the kind of story I get out of this, just watching it, is that you come along, you hit the personnel thing, because you think that's the hardest, I mean, the most immediate. You start looking at the force mix, so on, and these other things you've been talking about. Holloway comes along to consolidate, to stabilize, give a little breather because of the rapid change. But he's dealing with an almost impossible situation in congressional support, and he's really got a defense secretary that says no more carriers, and so on and so forth. So he's got a problem. Then Hayward comes along, and the materiel situation is even worse. Spare parts, etc. You're getting the continuing material consequence of that rapid tempo, up-tempo,
yeah.
that you started by talking about. And the equipment's really bad. Three different admirals told me, usually they say it's an oiler, but there seems to be a difference in what ship it was. But they all mentioned the ship that was tied up in Norfolk, unsafe to steam. One says it because of its boiling, another fellow says it because of the complement. And then you get, at the end of the Hayward time, that money situation gets changed, turned around for career people, etc. And then you get begin to get money for spare parts, and you begin to get an upward spiral. You see it sort of like this?
Yes, and that upward spiral really didn't begin until the Reagan administration.
I started out saying that, and I find people showing me figures for the last part of the Carter time.
In the last year after the invasion of Afghanistan, Carter, and partly I think because of his concern for re-election, did begin to hit it. I met with Carter early in his 4 years, and he was literally contemptuous from the military point of view. I was one of five or six people of the Committee on the Present Danger who met with him to try to persuade him he really had to get cracking. And then he called a group of us in from the Committee for a Democratic Majority, which I was a member, toward the end of his watch, and almost beseeched us to support him that he was doing right by the military. So he did a remarkable conversion after the Afghanistan invasion. And the defense budgets that he left showed that. And one of the reasons that the Democrats were able to claim Mr. Reagan hasn't improved all that much on the Carter budget is because Carter upped the FYDP levels for the Reagan years toward the end of his watch. But I, in my conversation with the scores and scores of young people that keep in touch with me, I didn't get the picture of their perceiving any improvement in readiness until the Reagan dollars began to flow. And I think one of the bummest raps that the Reagan administration has taken is this assertion of the Aspens and so forth, that for $1 trillion, where's the readiness?
Where's it gone?
Where's it gone?
Right.
We have, for the first time in my lifetime, in peacetime, adequate spare parts, adequate munitions level, adequate overhaul. The backlog of overhauls is down and so forth.
You're right in what you just said. And I misspoke a little bit. The pipeline turns around in the last two Carter budgets.
The fleet doesn't see it.
Yeah, because a number of people have told me readiness conditions, given me facts and figures from about 82, 83,
right.
which is where the real change comes. How do you visualize what Hayward does then? I mean, how does it strike you?
Well, Hayward's years were 78 to 82. So he had 2 years of the Carter administration and the first 2 years of the Reagan administration. I think Tom had an uphill fight during his first 2 years and found a lot of support for what the Navy needed in his last two.
What do you think of his programs, you know, the pride and professionalism and so on?
I think it was probably the right thing for that era.
You don't consider that a reversal from what you were doing, but building on it.
Sure.
Yes?
Sure.
Yeah.
You know, the situation was completely different. Vietnam had begun to fade. Reenlistment rates were beginning to improve, but were continuing to improve. It was time to start concentrating on that sort of thing.
Would it be too far to take you if I put words in your mouth that said that in a way, the pride and professionalism was made possible by stopping the hemorrhage in your time? Do you feel that?
Yeah, I do.
All right. How do you visualize the Watkins time?
Well, I think that was... Jim Watkins had the advantage of having a very pro-Navy president and a very pro-Navy Secretary of Defense and Secretary of the Navy, and got magnificent budgets and was able to do all of those things that we had talked about being maybe. And I think he then was able to begin the Vernier improvement in personnel administration that flowed out of his moral leadership approach to things.
He strikes me as, he struck me from the very beginning. You know, I've known most of these people, as you realize, over the years. He struck me as a man who is very unusual in that he goes for the fundamental principle, but he's also a man who is very careful to talk about how you get there. I mean, that he, you know, the bottom line, so to speak.
And I think he was, by all odds, the most devout CNO we've had in my lifetime. And that contributed to his mindset with regard to people.
I've talked with various secretaries of the Navy, not laymen yet. We haven't connected, but I intend to. Various CNOs and so on. And inquired, you know, how they felt about the relationship between the CNO and the secretary. I have the impression, leaving laymen aside, that if there is friction, and there usually is some, then it's over personnel. And by personnel, that means flag appointments.
Yeah, the secretaries of the Navy vary so dramatically. There's far more variance, I think, between secretaries of the Navy than there are between CNOs. Basically, you can't find, in strategic thinking, a CNO that is different from Tweedledee or Tweedledum. We're all pretty much alike in our views of this geopolitical picture. Secretaries of the Navy vary all over the map from really incompetent ones, like Secretary Matthews, and I would include John Warner in that category, to magnificent professionals like Paul Nixon, Paul Ignatius, Tom Gates. And therefore, the relationship varies from one of almost adversarial in nature to one of true partnership. Probably the finest partnership ever between a secretary and a CNO was that of Paul Nitzer and Dave McDonald. Worked absolutely magnificently because Paul Nitzer was a geopolitician himself and brilliant in putting it across to McNamara and the president. And Dave and believed in the Navy, as did Dave McDonald, who was a superb professional. It worked extremely well there. In my case, it worked quite well with John Chafee, who was not the kind of a professional Paul Nitzer was, but nevertheless was ardently in support of having an adequate Navy and very keen on people initiatives to a very unworkable relationship with John Warner, who impressed me as being exclusively preoccupied with getting elected to the Senate and afraid of his shadow with regard to the decisions that had to be made in the daily business, which meant that we really had to go to the Secretary of Defense to get the Navy business done.
I know all those people, and so as you're talking, I'm putting that against my own impressions, and they track. John Layman, on the other hand, is a very unusual fellow. And I'm not talking just his personality. What strikes me, and I kind of like to have your comment, if you want, on his personality, but what interests me most, there's a good side and a bad side when I see it. The good side is he really got the political presence, and he really was out in front, and he got it for the Navy. The bad side, it seems to me, that he was gradually remaking the Navy, related to what I just said, in terms of how he operated it, and particularly in cleaning up or changing the business practices, the acquisition process, etc. My impression is that I really am still very unsettled in my own mind about the materiel command. I keep asking everybody all over about that, but you know, part of the reason it was done away with, according to people I talk to, it's because Layman felt that his assistant secretaries were being outranked by that four-star.
You know, that decision to put Chief Naval Material in the chain of command under the CNO was made while I was executive assistant to Paul Nitzen. And we put in hundreds and hundreds of hours getting to it. The actual order to do so came out after I had left and gone to sea, but the work led up to it had been done while I was working with Paul. Paul devoted a tremendous amount of attention to it. Clearly made the right decision. The other system had been a kind of a facade where the military had a direct line relationship with the secretary, but the CNO could say, look, by God, don't do it, or do this and do that, and they had to pay attention to him. So the CNO in those days had the power but not the responsibility. And this forced the CNO to be responsible in his